This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of the World Wide Wave on joy.org.au.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community. This is the World Wide Wave.
Good evening and welcome. It's World Wide Wave time, the show that takes you around the globe, one country at a time. And a hello and welcome to our Sydney listeners tonight on Star Observer Digital as a part of Mardi Gras 2014. Tonight you've got Dean, Damien and myself, Matt, taking you around the world where we're stopping off in Nepal. It's a country with quite an impressive record of positive legal changes for LGBT people since 2007. So why is discrimination against LGBT people still widely reported? Nepal was one of the first countries in Asia to make provisions for a third gender. But what does that really mean on the streets and in the villages? As the United Nations Human Rights Committee prepares for its five-yearly report on Nepal, how will the LGBT community be sure its voice is heard? To understand gay life in Nepal, tonight we speak with the Kaleidoscope Australia Human Rights Foundation, Dr. Douglas Pretzel and Dr. Paula Gerber.
This is Ulrike Lunacek, member of the European Parliament and co-president of the Parliament's LGBT intergroup on the World Wide Wave.
It's a World Wide Wave. We're taking around the globe one country at a time. And welcome to the studio from Kaleidoscope Australia Human Rights Foundation, Dr. Douglas Pretzel. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Matt.
And Dr. Paula Gerber. Hello, Paula.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. We're going to kick off with our show on Nepal tonight with some fun, fast facts to give you a bit of a flavour of the country that we're visiting tonight. Now, the Nepalese government, following the end of the monarchy in 2007, legalised homosexuality with the introduction of a whole range of new laws. Now, so it wasn't actually technically illegal before?
No, it's been legal in Nepal, but the police have used other legislation which has wide discretion to arrest LGBTI people.
And we're going to get into that one a bit more because discrimination seems to be a very recurrent theme in our research for tonight. Same-sex relationships. Now, interestingly, this is actually on the agenda, which is quite advanced.
It is indeed. In fact, it was the courts that put it on the agenda and directed the government to form a committee to investigate the possibility of legislating for same-sex marriage. But a bit like in Australia, it's come unstuck in Parliament.
Well, it's gone to a committee. Of course it's come unstuck. It's lots of people sitting around and, not a whole lot of results there.
No one will vote for me anymore.
Transgender rights, and this is probably one of the real standouts for the region, I think. Some very significant rights with regards to recognition of the third gender.
Exactly, and once again, it was the courts that were leading the way in this area. They said you can no longer discriminate against transgender or third gender. You must recognise that there is this other gender. But the problem arises when your identity card, which you need for almost everything you do in Nepal, the government is not issuing identity cards in the third gender. So the court said do one thing, the government's not necessarily implementing it.
The census for the first time did actually ask the question of if you are from a third gender. It gave a third option in the gender requirement.
Yes.
So again, very, very progressive. In the political arena, there are some parties that have platforms that that have LGBTI platforms, particularly the two largest parties have LGBT platforms and, in fact, have LGBT candidates.
Absolutely. There are openly LGBT people who are members of Parliament.
I think the last election they had in Nepal, 62 candidates were actually lesbian, gay or transgendered, which must be a record, I would think.
It's huge.
Hang on. Nepal, for those, maybe we should take a bit of a step back and mention that it's that tall, pointy country in between India and China with 8 of the 10 highest mountains in the world. So population's approximately the same as Australia, I understand, about 23 million or so.
Yeah.
So what percentage of their parliament is gay and lesbian, if that's, or LGBTI?
At this stage, we don't know how many actually won, but there were 62 that went into the election.
Oh, I see. I got very excited then for a second.
It's actually been so that they went to the polls in November, but yeah, they've only just come in the last few weeks to the point where they've elected the government has done the deal to become elected and elected their premier. So, yes, it's a very protracted process.
Mm.
We will explore that a bit more. In terms of human rights groups, so there are some LGBT groups on the ground. The most dominant, I guess, would be the Blue Diamond Society.
That's right. It was formed in 2001, and it really has been providing incredible leadership for the LGBT community in Nepal, and has been very proactive, including in bringing those cases before the courts that resulted in such landmark decisions.
And in fact, Sunil Pant, who is was the head of Blue Diamond for a very long time, was also the first openly gay politician in Nepal.
That's right. Yep.
That's certainly taking it to them.
This is Nikki from Canada, where everybody can get married. You're listening to the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time.
Now, we are joined tonight as we discuss Nepal by Kaleidoscope Australia Human Rights Foundation, Dr. Douglas Pretzel and Dr. Paula Gerber. Douglas, perhaps can you start by telling us a little bit about Kaleidoscope and how the organisation began here in Australia?
Kaleidoscope Australia began probably back in August, although we'd been doing a little bit of planning before that. We were inspired by the Kaleidoscope Trust in the UK, but we are an entirely separate organisation here in Australia. And the kind of work that we're focused on is in the Asia-Pacific region, working directly with activists on the ground, giving them a voice and helping them achieve their goals.
Why the Asia-Pacific region in particular?
Because the Asia-Pacific region is within the sphere of Australia, and because we have worked out an agreement with Kaleidoscope Trust that this is the part of the world that they aren't willing to stay up all night to deal with.
And if I can add to that, I think that what the media coverage has shown us recently is that many parts of the world are the ones that get the media's attention. Russia, Uganda, Nigeria. There are 17 countries in the Asia-Pacific region that still criminalise homosexuality, and they don't get any media coverage. Nobody's talking about it. So I think for a bit of balance, it's really important to have somebody in this region looking at what's going on here and what reform we could do here, and not have all the media's attention exclusively on African nations and Russia and the like.
Is that, do you think, the reason there's not quite the profile for this region, is that a cultural thing, or there's just bigger issues in other parts of the world?
I think the recent laws that have been passed in Nigeria and Uganda, and the violence that has flowed on from that, has been so extreme that it has really sort of captured the attention, and it's so new. And the same with Russia. This, the fact that they had the Olympics and the violence that ensued from the anti-gay propaganda laws, even though homosexuality is not criminal there, means that it's more sort of graphic, I guess, for the media. We don't get the same degrees of violence against LGBTI people here, although I'd argue we get the same degrees of discrimination.
Now, the reason we've got you in today, you've made a submission to the United Nations Human Rights Committee. The Human Rights Committee conducts a review of every country's human rights record every 5 years.
Not every country. The Human Rights Committee is the body that's responsible for monitoring compliance with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So there's currently 193 members of the United Nations, of which about 163 have ratified the ICCPR, as we call it, that International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And that's the body that's the treaty that makes criminalisation of homosexuality a breach of human rights. So about 163 out of 193 get reviewed every 5 years.
And one of those is Nepal.
That's right.
Now, Can you tell us a bit about that process that the UN runs?
Sure. Initially, the way the UN was set up, it was set up by state governments, by country governments, and they were very reluctant to cede any of their power or authority or control to this international body known as the United Nations. So they agreed that they would submit to reviews every 5 years, and that they would give a report to the committee about what they're doing to comply with the ICCPR. Of course, as you can well imagine, those reports are very much put a spin pro-government. And if you read the reports on Syria or Uganda or anywhere, you'd think there were no human rights violations at all. So what the committee does to get a more balanced understanding of human rights in the country is they invite civil society, non-government organisations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Kaleidoscope Australia, to submit what they call a shadow report. And they say, you give us your perspective on what's happening on the ground in these countries. They then review all these reports. They have a verbal dialogue with the state, not with civil society. We don't get a voice in the actual meetings. And then they issue concluding observations. And the concluding observations are a really powerful tool, I think, for local activists to use, where they can go, hey, this committee, this international committee of 18 respected human rights experts has said, Nepal, you have to enact anti-discrimination laws if you want to be complying with the ICCPR.
So, Paula, does that take the form of a minority report?
No, it's the concluding observations are from the entire committee, and so they have to agree together as a committee, and they tend to. The other thing that they do is that in some cases, parties have not only ratified the ICCPR, but they've also ratified what's known as the optional protocol, and that allows individuals to take a specific human rights complaint to the committee. And probably the most famous case of all would be Toonen in Australia, where Nick Toonen from Tasmania took a complaint that the Tasmania sodomy laws were a breach of human rights, and the committee found yes. But in that case, there were minority decisions. Some of the 18 members of the committee didn't agree, but the majority said no, to criminalise homosexuality is a breach of the ICCPR.
So individuals don't, unless under these special criteria, individuals don't make representations. I'm guessing, therefore, that human rights groups such as Kaleidoscope are therefore the vehicle to be able to tell individual stories and to find the collective issues?
Exactly. So we go out and we talk to the locals on the ground, and we do extensive research. And in this case with Nepal, we were very fortunate to have the international law firm DLA Piper provide us with pro bono services. They did a lot of the research necessary for this report, and they're currently doing more research for us. I think the next two that we're doing in our region are Japan and Cambodia. So they do a lot of the research. We talk to the local activists and say, this is what we found. Do you agree? Have we represented this correctly? And once everyone's in agreement, we then submit that report to the committee.
So it's a legal response?
Yes, absolutely.
It's written by legal people in order to fit in with other legal responses.
Yes, yeah. So it's necessary to be able to, you know, understand and interpret the laws there, understand the international law obligations, and work out where there's a disconnect between the local laws and the international laws.
Could it be seen, you know, what is Australia getting involved in Nepal for? You know, these outsiders coming in and telling us how life should be.
Yeah, very, very good question. In fact, we are, we wouldn't do this without the input and the approval, and in fact, the invitation of the locals. We in Australia, I'm an international human rights lawyer. I've got a lot of expertise in preparing shadow reports. I've submitted several in the past. So I've got the skills and expertise in this area that perhaps some people in Nepal don't, and the resources to do the research and the writing. So we're offering those services to other countries and if they want to take us up on that, we're happy to assist them. But I think, you know, the UN process, even their webpage, can be very intimidating. And for someone who's not an international human rights lawyer to try and figure out even that you've got a right to submit a shadow report, let alone how to draft an effective one, can be a bit of a challenge. So I think the complementing of the services that we provide with the local on-the-ground knowledge is a great match-up.
So presumably you wouldn't be invited to assist Japan with their actual report?
No, just because Japan has homosexuality is not criminal, there are still issues that LGBT communities there face, and that we can help them to bring that to the attention of the Human Rights Committee.
So it's not just developing countries that you would be assisting?
Absolutely not at all, no. Any country, I mean, I don't think there's any country in the world where you can say they have a perfect track record with LGBTI rights. There's always something that could be improved. For example, Australia just enacted legislation or amended our anti-discrimination legislation to include intersex. We're the first country in the world to do that. So, you know, that's one thing that every 192 countries around the world could replicate.
Oh, it's nice to be ahead on something.
Now, let's talk about Nepal in particular. From the start of the show, there's lots of positive things happening that have happened in a very short amount of time, really. Is this also a chance to sort of give Nepal a pat on the back for doing some good things?
Absolutely. You've got to remember that when you're dealing with the United Nations, it's a diplomatic process as much as it's a legal one. And the concluding observations that the committee comes out with aren't just all a big stick saying, Nepal, you must do this, you must do that. They also praise them and recognise them for the positive steps that they have taken. And so in our report, which is about 8.5 pages, the first couple of pages is highlighting the positive developments there and saying that, you know, we need to recognise that Nepal is being, you know, in some respects a leader in our region, in that you've got the court saying you've got to recognise the third gender, you've got the court saying you need to consider same-sex marriage. There's lots of great things happening in Nepal, but still lots of room for improvement.
Hi, my name is Kenneth. I'm from LGB Denmark. You're hearing me on the World Wide Wave.
You're on World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. And we are in Nepal this evening.
We have with us Dr. Douglas Pretzel and Dr. Paula Gerber from the Kaleidoscope Australia Human Rights Foundation. And we've been speaking about some of the positive things in Nepal, but, you know, your report does actually ask for some things. Tell us a bit more about the Public Offences Act.
Okay, so as I said earlier, there's no specific law criminalising homosexuality in Nepal, but there is a piece of legislation called the Public Offences Act, which is drafted in such broad terms that it gives the police very wide discretion to interpret what constitutes a public offence. And surprise, surprise, LGBT people protesting or...
They're more offensive. Is that what they're saying?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So, for example, Blue Diamond Society, which is the leading LGBT organisation there, put in a complaint that they were being harassed and discriminated against. The result was that they got investigated under a whole swag of laws that they hadn't got their licence up to date and all these sorts of things. So LGBT people in Nepal are still very much... not accepted in many parts of society and by the police. And so one of the things we're recommending is that the Public Offences Act be amended so that it's much narrower and clearer as to what constitutes a public offence, so it can't be misused by the police to target LGBT activists.
Given that there are still some fairly pro-LGBT laws there, but the police are choosing to... you know, take a different tack. Is there more of a cultural issue here? I mean, how do you... You can put the laws in place, but how do you actually change things for the daily lives for LGBT people on the streets?
This is an area I've been researching and working on quite extensively. Do laws change culture, or does culture lead to change of laws?
Chicken and egg.
And I think it's a bit of both. I think you need to have that groundswell of civic movement to get law reform. And then once the law's changed, it brings about further cultural reform. So it's a bit of a tag team. So yes, on the one hand, you've got some, one might say, activist judges there who have made some wonderful decisions supporting LGBT rights, but more needs to be done, and more needs to be done by Parliament. It's one of the things that's lacking, I think, is political will. And once Nepal gets, for example, anti-discrimination laws, then we might start seeing more cultural change, because people will know that they are not allowed to discriminate against someone based on their sexual orientation or gender identity or gender expression.
Sexual assault is another thing that is highlighted in your response, which is that the sexual assault laws are currently very prescriptive. The offender is the perpetrator is the male, the victim is the female.
Yes.
What does that mean in terms of rape of men or third gender persons?
It means they're not classified as rape. So they, if they get charged at all, it's going to be for some much lesser offence, which obviously carries a lesser prison time if convicted, than if it was a, rape, which it would, it is for all intents and purposes, except that their law has that gender definition that male rape or rape of a third gender will simply not fall within.
Now, we were talking a bit about discrimination. Your report highlights this seems to be the top issue, this ongoing discrimination against LGBT people. What are you hearing from local people?
This has become a very interesting question because one of the things that I've been really focusing my research on a lot of late has been the number of countries around the world that criminalise homosexuality, which is currently 81. And I've published a web page, Anti-Gay Laws, that sets out all those 81 countries and their laws. And I got a post on it today from someone who said, I think you're focusing on the wrong thing. So many of these countries that have laws criminalising homosexuality, they're not actually enforced. And what we want and what we're campaigning for, this is someone in Africa, is anti-discrimination laws. Because until we have anti-discrimination laws, hospitals can refuse us treatment legally. We can be denied housing. We can be denied access to transport and all other basic services within society because of our sexual orientation or gender identity. So, yes, we do need to get rid of these criminal laws, but first and foremost, we want anti-discrimination legislation that protects us on the basis of our sexual orientation, gender identity or gender expression.
But how easy is it going to be to get anti-discrimination legislation for something that's considered to be, I mean, illegal? I mean, what's the answer to that?
It's interesting that in our region, Fiji actually had an anti-discrimination law in their constitution before they decriminalised homosexuality as well. And actually, it was kind of a necessary first step for them.
Is it more palatable for the general populace to accept discrimination than to accept homosexuality in some of these cultures?
Well, I think in Fiji, I'm not quite sure what the reason was for putting the anti-discrimination law in the first place, but given that it was there, it made it easier to decriminalise later. It made it easier in the courts and with the senior politicians to take that view.
It seems to be less high profile to enact anti-discrimination legislation than to decriminalise. So that seems to get a lot of the homophobes out there banging the drums if they try and decriminalise homosexuality. But if you pass general anti-discrimination legislation that happens to include sexual orientation and gender identity, that seems to slip through a bit more easily. But what's become very apparent is you need a leader. You need someone within the political movement who's prepared to take courage of this and to really drive it and take it forward. And without that individual taking charge of it, it's very difficult to get that sort of reform.
Now, the third gender, something we spoke about before, and where Nepal is pretty much ahead of the game in with regards at least to the Asia Pacific region, yet only three people have been documented so far to have actually taken the legal step to become a third gendered person.
Well, who succeeded in getting that. So I think this is a case where you can have the law on the books, but unless you have the means of enforcing it, of providing a remedy if it's not complied with, then having the laws there doesn't necessarily mean that much, isn't that effective. So you've had the Supreme Court come down many years ago and say, you must recognise third gender. Unless you have your identity card with your third gender on it, it's difficult to receive that recognition. The estimate in Nepal is that there's about 200,000 people who would identify as a third gender, and as you mentioned, only three of them have succeeded in getting their identity cards changed to their third gender. Again, it's that political will. The government's not setting up the regulations, not giving the directive to their civil servants, their public servants, to give effect to this Supreme Court decision.
Could it be argued, though, that the courts are moving faster than the population in terms of change?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's what we saw in America as well. I mean, the first jurisdiction to legalise same-sex marriage in the United States was Massachusetts because of the Supreme Court case. And it's taken a long time for the rest of the country, and arguably a lot of parts still haven't, caught up with that Supreme Court decision. So, yes, the court may be ahead of the time. ahead of its time or ahead of where the public was ready to go. But I think it's and they can drag along society to come and accept equality and dignity of all people.
You've now submitted your submission to the United Nations Committee. What happens next and when does it happen?
It happens at the end of March. In the last, about the 23rd to the 28th of March, is about five countries that the UN Human Rights Committee is going to be reviewing, one of those being Nepal. They will hopefully read and review our shadow report, along with others from more general human rights organisations. And then they will retire and write their concluding observations, which we, you know, fingers crossed, will include a recommendation or several recommendations about how Nepal can improve its treatment of LGBTI people, and then local activists on the ground and the international community will use those concluding observations to keep pressure on the government to enact reform.
And Douglas, what's next on the cards for Kaleidoscope?
What's next on the cards? We're going to be participating in the Darwin Conference around the
Asia-Pacific Outgames?
Exactly.
Excellent.
Yeah. So Doug Pollard will be going up and presenting there.
Who is very well known here at Joy.
Absolutely, and he will be meeting with many of the activists in our region who are also participating in the Human Rights Conference there. We have another series of shadow reports coming forward.
Yep, and as you heard, we only had our first board meeting in August last year, so we're a very new and young organisation, but we're looking at pursuing some training opportunities in the future and compiling a series of quite comprehensive reports on the state of LGBT rights in all countries in the Asia-Pacific region that will hopefully be a valuable resource for people wanting to know, well, what's the position in Vanuatu or in Singapore or anywhere else? They'll be able to go to this report and say, oh, okay, they don't have anti-discrimination laws. Homosexuality is legal. They're having pride marches. They're working towards marriage equality or whatever the issue may be.
It's great to have your support for the Asia-Pacific region. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Douglas Prestel and Dr. Paula Gerber from Kaleidoscope Australia.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you, Joy.
Bonjour, je suis Sébastien Lipschitz et je suis sur Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9.
You're with us on Joy 94.9. It's the Worldwide Wave, taking you around the globe one country at a time. And a huge thank you to Douglas and Paula for their insights into Nepal. Now, we have a lot of new listeners tonight up in Sydney. Hello, Sydney. They are joining us on Star Observer Digital Radio. Now, this is a project run with 2SER in Sydney, 107.3, where they take feeds of LGBT programs from around Australia. A fair few from here at Joy, being Australia's first and only full-time gay and lesbian radio station, and also 4ZZZ, Radio Adelaide, SYN here in Melbourne, and Radio RTR, as well as their own stuff. So if you're listening in Sydney, you can find out more at 2ser.com. It's Star Observer Digital Radio, your sex, sexuality and gender-diverse radio station. Time for us now to do a bit of a worldwide wrap. It's where we go around the world to see what's hot in news and what's interesting.
It looks like we're starting off in Finland. So Finland Parliament begins debate on a bill to legalise same-sex marriage. So in Helsinki, Finland, the Finnish Parliament began the debate on Thursday to legalise same-sex marriage. Should the legislation become law, Finland would become the final Nordic country, along with Denmark, Norway, Iceland and Sweden, to pass a law on gender-neutral marriage. The previous attempt in the Parliament's last session had failed.
Now, interestingly, you can. This is a show we spoke to, among other people, Mr. Gay Finland, but also some activists within Finland. So you can find that on our webpage, joy.org.au/worldwidewave. It's a really interesting listen. They have this device where they can put up the citizens can put up an initiative. So they've got to get 50,000 signatures. And if they get 50,000 signatures for something, the parliament has to debate it. And so the pro same-sex marriage group got 166,000 signatures. There was a counter petition by the homophobes. They only got 42,000, so their motion couldn't be debated. So
denied.
Bop-bop. Some perhaps not so good news. So two things. We are watching the news feed as we speak because around about 7 o'clock tonight, the Ugandan president, 7 o'clock our time, the Ugandan president Museveni was going to sign the anti-gay bill into law. This is the long-running bill that we have mentioned many times. And one of the most concerning things with this law is the potential for, if you like, the domino effect. There's already lots of African countries that have quite harsh laws. Now, Malawi is actually looking, or there are certainly voices within Malawi looking to move against homosexuality and bring in some very harsh laws there as well.
Well, it would become the ninth country to sort of have introduced the death penalty for homosexuality. So let's hope that doesn't happen.
Somebody that is taking the LGBT rights to very high levels is Billie Jean King, who is the famous tennis player, and she was a part of the American delegation to the Sochi Olympics, and she has come out calling for the IOC to consider LGBT rights as a part of selecting the countries who are to host future games, because it's a part of their charter under Principle 6.
And back at home, the Brisbane City Council has banned the queer film festival image, which is actually very much, basically taken from the classic film with Burt Lancaster, was it? From Here to Eternity, featuring two men kissing on a beach and rolling around the waves, which I'm sure has never happened in Queensland before.
It's a very nice black and white image too, but this is not the first time that Queensland has been known to pull very inoffensive images, calling them offensive. In fact, there was an outcry when the ad operator up there for outdoor advertising did exactly the same thing with the Rip and Roll campaign. There was national outcry, and they then reversed their decision and put up the images. But this one, no, I don't think it's offensive.
Well, I mean, obviously we're the target demographic, but I mean, let's hope the same thing happens with the Rip and Roll campaign, where there was a national outcry followed by national eye rolling from everyone who just couldn't get over what a storm in a teacup it really was.
Queensland. Somewhere where there is very strong support for the LGBT community is Ireland. The latest poll in Ireland puts support for same-sex marriage at 76%. So they are pushing very hard for same-sex marriage to come along. They've got a lot of support across the community, and really good news.
To be sure. However, despite this, 49% of respondents said they did have reservations about same-sex marriage, a higher percentage than when asked if they had reservations about gay couples adopting children, which was 41%. But, you know, we're getting there.
And while we're in the area, let's talk about the UK, where gay men are to be banned from becoming queen. Yes, you heard it here. There've been a whole range of laws being changed to do with the Same-Sex Couples Act. And what they've, in making this change, they've been going back through their laws. They found laws back to the year 1285 that need to be amended, 700-year-old laws that haven't been updated in that time. Relevance. So at the moment, if you're gay, you can't be queen. So, if you're not already.
So basically, if Prince Harry was to jump the fence, he wouldn't be able to marry someone and they wouldn't be called princess. They'd have to be, you know, well, actually probably Earl or something like that. There have been a number of same-sex attracted monarchs. We'd have to look at William II, Edward II, James I, and of course there's a lot of rumours about Richard the Lionheart. So, but they didn't have gay marriage
really,
back then.
Really did hear it first. You're on the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Hi, my name is Kenneth. I'm from LGB Denmark. You're hearing me on the World Wide Wave.
Thank you very much to our wonderful guests from Kaleidoscope Human Rights Foundation Australia, Dr. Douglas Pretzel and Dr. Paula Gerber.
And you can keep track of LGBT news from around the world right throughout the week by joining us on Facebook. It's World Wide Wave on Facebook. And a thank you and a hello to Liao, Joanna and Pog, who've messaged or interact with us throughout the week.
We do read it. And thank you to Robert at the front counter.
Next week, we've got our 100th show. We're going to have a bit of a party. We look forward to seeing you then. This has been World Wide Wave. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the World Wide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.